All right. Good evening once again for the last time. So some of you have been to all of these sessions every evening since Wednesday. Well done. Boy, that's... And now we're going to wrap it up with quite a lot of probably new information for most of you, so I expect that I'm going to see some heads exploding here with too much information over such a short period of days. So, but tonight our topic is Noah's Flood. Noah's Flood, the event that reshaped the earth. When somebody talks about Noah's Flood, you're doing a Bible study on it or something like that, what image of the flood pops into your imagination? What was the flood like? How violent was it? If a number of years ago there was a mini-series on NBC about Noah's Flood, John Voight, famous actor, portrayed Noah. And if that's the picture that you have in your mind about what the flood was like, well, Noah was walking around on the deck of the ark, contemplating God's judgment, and Lot rowed up to him in a rowboat. It's beautiful and sunny, and there was small waves, and Lot, at the time of Noah, rowed up to him in a rowboat. And they exchanged some food, some chickens, and things like that. If that's the picture that you have of Noah's flood in your mind, then tonight is going to be pretty eye-opening. But that was the way NBC TV network portrayed it. Sometimes I think NBC stands for no biblical content. But the flood was extremely, extremely violent. Let's review a little bit as we talk about the flood and about things dying especially. Billions of people could have literally missed the boat at the time of Noah. And, of course, all kinds of animals died as well. We've mentioned this already. You haven't seen this image yet. But imagine in your head the Garden of Eden. There's Adam and Eve. Oh, Adam, this is such a perfect world. Yes, Eve, it's very good, just like God said. But if you, as a Christian, want to bring in millions of years into Genesis, this is the picture that you have to accept. The Garden of Eden, which God called very good, He called His completed creation very good, but underneath that is a worldwide fossil record with death, pain, killing, disease, struggle, suffering, extinction, all kinds of other things. But we mentioned already, we've mentioned this a number of times, that that is not accurate. That's the picture that sort of has to be in your mind if you want to marry millions of years with Genesis. But the millions of years aren't true. We've been saying this over and over again and giving examples from biology and tonight's geology. We've looked at genetics. We've looked at astronomy and the Big Bang and so on. Things just aren't that old. They just aren't. Yesterday was our Age of the Earth night, and we talked about that. This would be a far more accurate representation of reality. The Garden of Eden destroyed and buried in the flood, and then on top of that, you have a worldwide fossil record. So we would have no idea where the Garden of Eden was today. It was completely destroyed in the flood. Could have been here in Hessen. We don't know. Why not? And on top of that, the worldwide fossil record. So then the fossil record is not the evidence, it's not a record of life on the earth over millions of years. It's not a record of history. It's a record of the living things that were killed at the time of the flood. So anyone who goes to the fossil record and tries to understand it in terms of millions of years of biblical history cannot possibly come to the right conclusions about the fossil record. Because it's in fact evidence for Noah's flood. Or evidence for the flood, as some would prefer. Ron in the back there. The flood. We call it Noah's flood, but it was God's flood, wasn't it? Let's just point. I've never heard anyone bring that up before. Why do you call it Noah's flood? I don't know. I've always called it Noah's flood. But it's the flood, and Noah was involved as well. But that's a more accurate picture. The world that then was being overflowed with water perished. It died. It was destroyed. And on top of that, we have a worldwide fossil record. So, this evening we're going to be looking at geology. We've looked at biology. We've looked at astronomy. This is our night for geology. A flood is going to have geologic effects. It's going to rip up rocks from one area and deposit them somewhere else. Erosion and deposition. That's geology. Sedimentary rock, and that's what the flood would do on a massive scale, as we're about to find out. The layers of rock containing fossils, which are found all over the world, are either the result of millions of years of geologic processes or the result of a global flood. It cannot be both. That's our first point as we dive into this topic this evening. You have an either-or situation here. You either have millions of years, and that is used to explain the layers of rock that contain fossils, or you have a global flood. If you have both, millions of years and a global flood is going to rip up all of the evidence for millions of years and redeposit it. So you can't have both. It's either a flood or millions of years. And there are Christians who've accepted the millions of years, and they recognize that you can't have both, so they say, well, Noah's flood wasn't global. Because you can't have both a global flood and millions of years. So they say, well, it must have been a little flood, a local flood, only within the ancient Mesopotamian area, only within over in the Middle East, the modern Middle East. Well, let's look at what the Bible text says about a local flood. Here it is here, Genesis 7. The waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. A cubit is a distance from the tip of your hand to your elbow, so roughly 20 feet deep. How can you have a local flood and have it cover all the high mountains under the whole heavens? The language here in Genesis is pretty clear. It was a global flood. If you're covering all the high mountains under the whole heavens, what else is there still to cover? Nothing. It's a global flood. And what would that look like? If you're going to be a Christian and then say, well, no, this is really referring to a local flood, a flood only within the Mesopotamian area. Well, the Mesopotamian area is not a bowl. You can't fill it up. We had one of our graphic designers do an image of what a mountain-covering flood only within the Middle East would look like, and this is what he came up with. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. How do you cover the mountains only under a portion of the world and have it 15 feet above the mountain? It doesn't make any sense. And then have you thought about the inconsistencies? If you're going with a local flood, here's something to consider. Why did God have Noah build an ark? Why not just tell him to move? It's a lot easier, a lot less work. Noah, pick up and move. I'm going to flood this area here. And why did Noah need to build an ark so large that it was capable of carrying two of every, seven of some, but two of every land-dwelling, air-breathing animal? If there's a flood in a particular area and some animals get wiped out, it's no big deal. After the water subsides, the other animals repopulate, right? Is that a problem? The ark was meant to carry two of every animal. If it's only a local flood, that doesn't make sense. Why did Noah take birds on the ark? If it's only a local flood, birds get up and fly away. And yet Noah was told to take birds on the ark. And have you thought of the rainbow? The rainbow is a covenant from God to us that God will never destroy the earth in that manner again. You might imagine a father and son looking up at a rainbow. Look at that beautiful rainbow. It's a promise from God that he'll never again flood the entire earth as he did in Noah's day. My Christian college professor said that Noah's flood didn't cover the entire earth. He told you it was just a localized flood? That's what he said. So he believes that God promised never again to send a localized flood. You know what? There have been thousands of local floods, of little floods, since the time of the Great Flood. God would have been repeatedly breaking his promise if Noah's flood was just a little flood. But God hasn't broken his promise. Noah's flood was global, and there has never again been another global flood. See, there's Christian colleges that teach evolution. There's Christian colleges, Christian seminaries, Bible colleges that blend millions of years in with Old Testament courses when you're taking Genesis. Oh, just add the millions of years in there, it's no problem. But then, of course, the flood needs to be local. It needs to be a little flood. Because, again, you can't have both millions of years and a global flood. Now, where did the millions of years come from? We spent a little bit of time talking about this yesterday. In the 1700s and 1800s, late 1700s, early 1800s, people like James Hutton and Charles Lyell, and then after them, many others, began promoting the idea of millions of years. And the idea came from a reinterpretation of geology, of the rocks, specifically the sedimentary rocks. That's rock that was laid down by moving water, or perhaps as a sand dune, something like that. And scientists at that time, they said things like, well, the Bible's not true. These rock layers show that the earth is millions of years old. You have to believe me. I'm a scientist. And isn't it true that whenever we see a scientist on, or somebody who looks like a scientist, maybe a guy with a white beard and a white lab coat, and he says, well, you should use this toothpaste and not this toothpaste, and it seems that, well, he has some air of authority, doesn't he? He may know nothing about toothpaste, but because he looks like a scientist, we think, oh, well, he must know what he's talking about. And pastors and theologians back at that point, they didn't know how these guys were coming up with millions of years, but they thought, well, these guys, they must know what they're talking about. And don't we think that today still? How can so many scientists be wrong? And pastors and theologians said, well, I'll just accept the millions of years and add it into the Bible. And then the challenge became, where do you fit the millions of years? Do you stretch out the days and make each one of those millions of years long? We talked about that last night. Or maybe it goes in the gap theory between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. And we talked about that as well. That's an impossibility given the original Hebrew. Or somewhere else. I've heard an amazing array of how you get the millions of years into Genesis. I remember years ago, we had a booth at the Evangelical Theological Society, the ETS meeting. This is a group, this meeting happens annually, and it's in a different major city each year, usually in North America. Theologians from all over the world get together to discuss the latest in theology. And we had a booth at one of these meetings, and the majority of theologians believe in millions of years, sadly. It's sad, but it's true. And we had a booth there with some books and so on, and they all knew who we were, and they knew our position. And there's so many conversations. The guys would come up to the table, and so many conversations could be started with the phrase, this is my way to get the millions of years into the Bible. And then off they go with some creative idea. I remember one of them, he said that the physical structures of the earth, rocks and trees and living things and so on, are young, but the atoms that compose those physical structures are billions of years old. Where do you get that in Scripture? It's just amazing. And it's a collection of theologians. It's all kinds of theologians that get together. It's amazing. I've never seen so many bearded, bald-headed guys together in my life. What is it with theologians? They're all bald and have beards. I don't get that. But all these notions are really attacks on Genesis. They're reinterpretations of the plain text in Genesis. Local flood, theistic evolution, day age. We talked about that yesterday. The days being millions of years long. Progressive creation, gap theory. They're all attacks on the straightforward understanding of Genesis. So let's go back to geology. Let's make some observations and let's see whether it's millions of years or a global flood that can explain these things. So in the next few minutes, we're going to make some observations in geology. Now, the question before us as a church, as Christians, is how do we explain how those observations came to be? The evolutionists have explanations, and they explain it in terms of millions of years and slow and gradual process of the earth slowly changing, slowly evolving over millions of years. Slow erosion, slow deposition. So how do we explain that in a biblical context? That's the challenge as we look at these geologic features. A large amount of geologic change has occurred since the earth began in erosion and deposition, the two main features of geology happening today. There's also volcanism, volcanoes, but we're looking at erosion and deposition here this evening. For example, here's a cross-section of the Grand Canyon area. Here's the canyon over here. So if you're a tourist, most of the tourists go to the south rim, or the south rim's over here. This is south, this is north up here. So you're standing at the rim looking at the canyon. If we follow the strata here in green, further to the north, you can follow it along there, further to the north, there's thousands of feet of additional layers of rock. How much of those layers at one point extended over the Grand Canyon area? There's good evidence for a couple of thousand feet, maybe more, over the Grand Canyon area. So the first thing we notice is there's deposition. These layers cover a huge extent in the American Southwest, and some of them can actually be traced to England. The lowest layers, the Tapete Sandstone, the lowest of the horizontal layers here, can actually be traced over to England. What could produce that? And how come there's that much erosion? Here's another view of the canyon here. Here's the canyon over here again on the right. And further to the north, we have Zion Canyon and Bryce Canyon, some beautiful canyons there in Southwest America. And tourists would stand here and look down to the river, or if you're rafting, you'd be down here, of course. But further to the north, there's all this additional strata. How much of that existed over the Grand Canyon area in the past and then was eroded? So we've got a massive amount of deposition, and then we have a massive amount of erosion. There's a lot of rock missing. So how do we explain that? There's two possible explanations. Which one is correct? Either it was caused by processes operating over millions of years, that's the standard interpretation, or it was caused by a major geological catastrophe. Now we can make some more observations. The huge extent of some rock layers, and we can highlight one of the layers in Grand Canyon. Here's the Coconino Sandstone. You can see it here in the foreground. There it is on the other side. It's this layer right here, the Coconino Sandstone. Here's a map showing its extent. It covers more than 200,000 square miles in the American Southwest. The total volume of sand in this sandstone is estimated to be greater than 10,000 cubic miles. 10,000 cubic miles of sand. There's nothing of that magnitude forming anywhere on Earth today, underneath the oceans or anything. That's huge. A huge extent of some rock layers. Here's another one, another observation. Flat and smooth transitions between layers. The contact line in a lot of places between these layers is flat and smooth. Now, it seems to suggest that when the deposition of one of the layers stopped or slowed down, there wasn't a whole lot of time gap between when the deposition of the next layer began. If that surface had been exposed for a long period of time, you wouldn't expect it to be flat, would you? It would be eroded. You'd have rain, you'd have a soil zone there at the top, topsoil would form, there'd be plants pushing roots down and so on, and it would be eroded. It wouldn't be flat and smooth. And yet, most of the contact lines here between these various strata are flat and smooth. It's an interesting observation. When I was hiking out of the canyon in 1996, I took this picture. You've got down here on the bottom, this is the Hermit Shale Formation and the Coconino Sandstone. Geologists have given names to layers of rock in the same way that has been done in the early church. We've given names and chapter and verse to Bible verses so that we can reference them quickly. Geologists have done the same with rocks around the world. They give these rocks names. And then geologists know what other geologists are talking about. Look at that contact line. Beautiful, flat, and smooth. You can trace it for miles throughout the canyon. Well, evolutionists believe at that location there's 10 million years of missing time. That the Hermit Shale down here was exposed to the surface for 10 million years before the deposition of the Coconino began. There's an interesting observation. So that one doesn't really fit with evolution. Here's another one. Buried upright trees. Trees buried upright. Here's a drawing of a cliff. This is in Craigleith near Edinburgh in Scotland. Guys were taking rocks out of this quarry, and they came across this tree going through multiple layers of rock. Here's a photograph of a vertical fossil tree with its base in a coal seam. That's from Tennessee, down south. How did that happen? Trees don't grow in coal. And how can it extend through multiple layers? If those layers were laid down, you know, a centimeter per year, the top of the tree would have rotted long before it was ever buried. The whole thing must have been buried at once. So how do we explain that? How do the evolutionists explain that? There's a picture of a drawing of a cliff in France. You can see people down there for scale. Trees going through multiple layers of rock. Out in Joggins, Nova Scotia. It's a World Heritage Site. There's trees just like this going through multiple layers of rock. Here's another observation. Large animals, in some cases, are buried whole. Dinosaurs, in some cases, have been found pretty much intact. Like, they're buried whole. There's a fellow working on a dinosaur in Utah, dinosaur fossil. And it's mostly intact. You can see its tail is broken up. Its back is broken up there at the top of the picture. It's no longer together. But it's pretty much intact still. The geology of the ocean bottom. Layers of sedimentary rock sitting directly on the bottom of the ocean correspond to young layers on land. Where are the older layers? So if we drill down into the rocks in the bottom of the ocean, those layers, you can line them up with layers on land. The problem is on land, underneath those layers, there's all kinds of older layers. but the older layers are missing on the bottom of the ocean. It's only young layers of rock on the bottom of the ocean. How do we explain that? It seems to suggest that the ocean bottoms themselves are young. That we had a new ocean bottom, and it only preserved the younger layers, which correspond to the ones on land. Here's another one, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. What's that all about? How do Christians explain that? We've got the world's longest canyon, world's longest mountain chain, in a sense, down for thousands of kilometers down the middle of the Atlantic there. There's a geologic observation. As Christians, how do we explain that in a biblical framework, in a way that's satisfactory to geologists, to people who are wrestling with Christianity and thinking, well, is the Bible really true? Can we explain things like this? Does it make sense? Here's another one. The continents have a jigsaw puzzle-like fit. If you look over here again, Africa seems to fit in over here. If you take into account the continental shelf and so on, South America seems to fit in over here. It sort of has a jigsaw puzzle-like fit. And then, in addition, when you take measurements of the magnetism out from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge on both sides, the magnetism in the rocks changes. It flips from north, south, north, south, as you measure from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge back to the continent. And it's a mirror image on both sides of that Mid-Atlantic Ridge. It seems to suggest that when new ocean floor at that point was produced, ocean floor would come up, and as the continents were moving apart, the Earth's magnetic field was flipping back and forth, north, south, north, south. And that magnetism was recorded in the rocks when they cooled and solidified. Interesting. How do we explain that? What is the cause of such a large amount of geologic change? So we've just looked at a number of very, very large geologic structures on a continent or even larger than continent level. What's the cause of that? Well, creation has been thinking about that for a long time, and back in the 90s, creationists recognized an important concept and proposed a radical idea. The concept is that the ocean plates are heavier than the mantle, the material they're floating on. Here's what we're talking about. This section here is the mantle. This is the core, the Earth's core down here. And here is the ocean plates. This is the Atlantic Ocean, Africa over here, South America over here. These ocean plates would be composed of mantle material that has cooled. So when you take something and you have a hot version of that something and you have a cooler version of that same material, the cooler material is heavier, is more dense than the hot material, isn't it? And so these cool ocean plates are heavier than the mantle. That's unstable. If you have something heavier on top of something lighter, what gravity wants to do is turn it like this. Pull the heavy stuff to the bottom, and the light stuff should go to the top. And that was the radical idea. What would happen if the pre-flood ocean began to subduct, began to sink? What if that ocean plate, and gravity wants to pull it down toward the core anyways, what would happen if it would start sliding down to the core? Would it lead to a runaway event? That was the really radical proposal. Would it go faster and faster and faster, recycling all of the pre-flood ocean floor into the earth? The pre-flood ocean floor. So here's what we're talking about. Here's the ocean floor. Down here's the mantle. And this might be BC out here and the West Coast. Now this is the Pacific Plate. It's being pulled by gravity down toward the core. This material is heavier than the material underneath it. So it's unstable. There's an instability there gravitationally. And creationists thought, could it start and then go faster and faster? So then if you, in one part of the world, if the plates are sinking into the earth, obviously on the other part of the world, you've got to create new ocean floor. If the ocean floor in one place is shrinking, then you've got to produce new ocean floor somewhere else, right? Which means a ripping apart of the original supercontinent. Or ripping apart in somewhere on the earth. That has to happen. So that's what creationists began toying with in the early 90s and thinking, you know, let's do some research and see if this is a possibility to work toward explaining some of the geology that we just looked at very quickly. Many lines of evidence indicate that the continents have moved apart. That I talked about some here. There's many other lines of evidence. continental, the split has happened. And so for Christians, the only place in biblical history where this could have happened was during the flood. Now some people say, wait a minute, what about in Genesis 10:25 where it says, in the days of Peleg the earth was divided? Could the Bible be referring to an event like this in the days of Peleg? The answer is no. Because that verse is referring not to the division of the physical earth, it's referring to the division of the people of the earth by language. It's the event of the Tower of Babel. That's what it's referring to. And for reference, if you look at Genesis 11:1, now the whole earth, aretz, that's the same word in Hebrew that's used in Genesis 10:25, the whole earth had one language. Well, it's not referring to the earth, the physical earth. It's referring to the people of the earth by language. That's what it's referring to. If this event that I'm about to describe, the breakup of the supercontinent originally, the opening up of the Atlantic Ocean, if that were to happen with people living on the continents, they would have been killed. That's how catastrophic this is. And you'll see that in just a few minutes here. Now, creationists have called this catastrophic plate tectonics. So this is... You've heard of continental drift? Is that familiar? That's a familiar term? Well, this is not continental drift. This is continental sprint. We've got about a year-long time period here to work with. You all know that the flood wasn't 40 days and 40 nights, right? That was the onset of the flood. And then after that, there was 5 months. And after that, there was a number of weeks. And altogether, it's a little over a year that Noah was on the ark. 371 days. From when God closed the door to when He opened the door and all the people and animals got off. So we've got about a year to work with here. There's some questions for the biblical model. In order for this model, this scientific idea that creationists had to make sense, to even be considered seriously, some questions need to be answered. The model needs to answer these questions. How can the pre-flood ocean plates, which are obviously made of rock, slide quickly through the earth's mantle, which is also made of rock? There's this notion that you have the ocean plates and the continental plates, and they're sitting on molten material. That's not quite accurate. The mantle is still solid rock. Much of it is at about 80% of its melting temperature, but it's still solid rock. So that question applies. How do you slide rock through rock? In other words, can the friction be overcome? You've got a huge amount of friction there. It's not that it's liquid, that it's a frictionless surface. Can the friction be overcome? That was a serious question that needed to be answered in order for this to be taken seriously. Here's another one. What mechanism would move the continents apart so quickly? So, okay, if you could get the plates to begin sinking, you still got the challenge of, on the surface of the earth, you're moving continents around, billions and billions and billions of tons of rock at some pretty high speeds to open up the Atlantic Ocean. What's the engine? What's the motor? What's the mechanism that drives that lateral movement on the surface of the earth? That was a big question. What are the consequences of continental sprint? So when you're moving billions of tons of rock around on the earth at the kind of speeds that it would need to be moving around in order to happen during a flood, would there be so much friction that you'd melt the surface of the earth? That was a real consideration. Some creationists were saying this is never going to work as a viable model for us to explain these geologic features because the earth is going to melt. It's so catastrophic. It would create so much heat that it wouldn't work. Well, the only way a model like this can be tested today is in computer simulation. You can't build a physical model of the earth. If you built a scale model of the earth and tried to do it physically, it wouldn't work. It's computer modeling. The main goal of the computer model was to determine if the viscosity, or the friction, if you like, in the mantle could be overcome to allow runaway plate subduction. Could the plates go faster and faster and faster, overcoming that friction, so that all of the pre-flood ocean plates are, like a big conveyor belt, are cycled into the earth? That's the goal of the computer model, or one of the goals. First, we need to know the properties of the rock in the mantle, obviously. Now, fortunately, that's documented by decades of laboratory experiments. Here's one of the apparatuses used to do that. You put your sample inside here. You can vary the temperature up to 2,000 Kelvin, and you apply stress with these rods here. You can stress your sample at various pressures and temperatures. And then you take it out and look under a powerful microscope. You can see here planes of atoms have slidden past one another. The material has deformed under stress. And you can do that at various temperatures and so on, and figure out what would happen if we'd stress the rocks in the mantle, and then you put it all in graphs like this. And if you're taking notes, I'll just give you a minute to get that down. Good, let's move on. The first step of the computer model was, it was a two-dimensional computer model, and it was built by the world's leading plate tectonic modeler and run on a Cray supercomputer. Now, let's just pause here for a moment. There are folks out there who say that, well, there aren't any real scientists who don't believe millions of years. There aren't any real scientists who believe creation. Well, Dr. John Baumgartner is the world's leading geophysicist in modeling plate tectonics. He's given that title by other geophysicists around the world. He's the number one expert in the world that we have today in modeling plate tectonics. And he is a six-day young Earth Bible-believing creationist. He's on our side. And the Cray supercomputer, all the computations in Dr. Baumgartner's model that he had to put in there, all the physics, the thermodynamics, the conservation of energy, and so on, all of that that goes in there, a simple PC can't run this. Not even a Mac can run it, Jeremy, sorry. But you need a supercomputer. And back in the early days of the Cray company didn't even own one of their own computers. They're so big and expensive, only the government and the military can afford these things, right? So it's a powerful, powerful computer. Now, computer technology moves very, very quickly. Nowadays, you can get a Cray computer at the corner 7-Eleven, but no, I'm kidding. But it's still something of a powerhouse today. So here are the outputs from the Cray supercomputer. I'll just explain these to you here. This represents the Earth's mantle. Here's the surface of the Earth, and below here would be the Earth's core. You have a liquid core, and then at the center of the liquid core, this is a solid iron core. That's, nobody's been down there, but that's a good working theory. So we're interested in the mantle. What happens in here? The blue areas here are cool, low-temperature rock. The red areas are high-temperature rock. This represents the beginning of the process. The plates are beginning to be pulled by gravity, the ocean plates up here, beginning to be pulled by gravity down toward the core, the bottom of the mantle. And in other places, hot material is coming up to begin to replace that cold sinking material. This one down here is the viscosity, the friction, if you want to think of it that way. And this is the one that Dr. Baumgartner and the other scientists involved were quite interested in. Now, here's a little bit later in the process. You can see that a lot of cool material, that the ocean plates have been pulled by gravity, they're subducting through the mantle, down to the bottom of the mantle. In other places, lots of hot material has come up to form new ocean floor. And the viscosity down here in some places is all over the map. This might represent the end of the process. You've got virtually nothing left up top. It all either is sinking or has sunk. And in other places, a lot of hot material has come to the surface to form new ocean floor. Now, I've taken some of these outputs from the supercomputer and put them one after another in PowerPoint. We've got a bit of an animation here. It repeats a number of times. And you can see the time up here in days, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It goes up to 20 days. There's exponent 1 up to 20. And you can see the vectors there. Here's the speed in meters per second. It's starting at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Up to 7 meters per second of movement in the mantle. You can see it there how, with all the vectors and so on. So if you're into physics and you've worked with vectors before, you'll understand that. The bottom line is, theory, experiments, and computer simulations reveal that tectonic plates can sink rapidly. This crazy notion that creationists began toying with in the early 90s was absolutely verified by cutting-edge science done by the world's leading plate tectonic modeler on one of the world's most powerful computer systems. The answer is yes, this is not a crazy idea. This can absolutely happen. And if we were on the space shuttle or the International Space Station at the time of Noah, this might be what you'd kind of see. Of course, there's no cloud cover there, but you've got the breakup of the original supercontinent, something like that. So this can absolutely happen. See, what they discovered was that as the plate gets sinking, it generates, you can imagine, huge amounts of friction. You've got rock rubbing past rock. Now, that rock, that friction creates heat, which melts some of the rock, which almost acts like a lubricant. It's like pouring oil on a stuck hinge. And so the plate moves faster. which creates more friction, which generates more heat, which melts more rock. So the plate moves faster and faster and faster until it's all subducted into the earth. Amazing. So what are the consequences of catastrophic plate tectonics? What would happen if the continents are moving around at 7 meters per second? 7 meters per second is about 25 kilometers per hour. What happens on the surface of the Earth if you start moving continents around at 25 kilometers per hour? Well, molten magma erupts to create new ocean floor as the pre-flood supercontinent breaks apart. So the pre-flood, before the flood, there was one continent. That's generally understood, even among theologians. And then you've got this breakup, and you've got, here's the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Hot material is coming from the base of the mantle to form new ocean floor as that continent is pulled apart. And then at the same time, you've got the magnetic field flipping back and forth, recording that magnetism in the rocks as they cool. Number two, intense global rain is produced as huge quantities of seawater are vaporized. If you look kind of at the Earth's surface level, here's that hot new ocean floor coming up to the surface. Here's the cold sinking ocean floor sinking away. As seawater splashes onto this area, it flashes to steam to rise into the atmosphere to form thick clouds and intense global rain. Imagine all the way down the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, you're vaporizing huge amounts of seawater, which are then going to fall as rain. Some calculations have been done on how much seawater would be vaporized, which would then lead to rainfall. The calculations suggest global rainfall at a rate of 3 feet an hour. Can you imagine the kind of damage and hazard that would produce? Global rainfall, 3 feet an hour at the onset of the flood, when this begins. Any sediment that had accumulated on the pre-flood ocean bottom is scraped away and accumulates at the continent edges. There's another consequence of this process. So as this ocean plate is sinking and scraping past the continent, it's kind of like you're taking a spatula and you're getting out the last peanut butter in the peanut butter jar, right? You're scraping off any sediment that had accumulated here in the 1600 years before the flood is now scraped away and piles up at the edges of the continent. The hot new ocean floor is less dense than the cold sinking ocean floor, so it floats or it sits higher on the mantle. This results in the volume of the ocean basins being greatly reduced and global sea level rising dramatically. You remember Jacques Cousteau? Anybody remember that? Jacques Cousteau, you remember that name? He was a Frenchman who invented scuba, the underwater breathing apparatus, and he had these wonderful nature programs. He took cameras underneath and underneath the ocean and showed us the ocean on TV. It's fascinating. He was not a Christian, but he said that if you were to raise the ocean bottoms and lower the continents so that everything is even, there's enough water in the oceans today to flood the entire Earth to a depth of more than 2 miles. There's lots of water for a global flood, Cousteau was saying. All you need to do is have a little vertical adjustment between the continents and the ocean bottoms. That's exactly what this process would have done. This hot new ocean floor, it sits higher than the cold sinking ocean floor. The difference in elevation right here is about a mile. So the new ocean floor is now a mile higher than the old ocean floor. So what happens to the water that was in the oceans? Goes out over land. Intense water currents driven by the Earth's rotation arise over the now flooded continental areas. Some work has been done on what would the ocean currents look like if there were no continents to guide their path. The Earth is still rotating. You have different densities and temperatures of water. And you're going to have these, and in some cases, quite rapid circulations of currents over the continents, over the submerged continents. These currents spread thick sediment layers over huge areas of the continent. Well, that's going to explain observations such as the huge extent of some of those rock layers, like the Coconino sandstone that we observe in Grand Canyon. This process explains that very, very well. Most living things die. Some are rapidly buried and preserved as fossils. That's going to explain things like dinosaurs, buried whole, perhaps even buried alive. They didn't die and fall over and were slowly buried. They were rapidly buried, perhaps buried alive. The sinking ocean floor produces a stirring in much of the rock in the mantle, this is the mechanism that moves the continents apart, opening up the Atlantic and Indian Oceans. So you've got a stirring that's set up here in the mantle. And that stirring is what moves the continents on the surface. That's the mechanism. Remember, that was one of the things that the model needs to answer. Okay, well, if you can get the plates to sink, that's one challenge. But then how do you get the continents to move? Well, the energy of the sinking plates produces that stirring, which on the surface moves the continents. You have this rotation set up here, and you have the continents moving. Once all of the heavy pre-flood ocean floor has subducted or has sunk, the runaway episode ends and global sea level begins to fall. So the whole thing starts very quickly and ends very quickly. Once there's no ocean floor left, it just shuts down. It starts very quickly, gets going, goes quite rapidly, and then once all of the pre-flood ocean floor, the shelves underneath the oceans, once they're gone, it all shuts down. The continents can't subduct. In case you're wondering, would North America one day go bloop? It's not going to happen, right? It wouldn't make that sound anyway. But the continents underneath us is mostly granite. That's a lighter rock, and we actually float on the mantle. That's why we have continents where we do and oceans where they do, because the ocean plates are heavier. They sink into the mantle more than the continents do. That's why we have water in that lower area. At this point, water rushes from the continents and erodes much previously deposited sediment. So at the onset of the flood, we've got episodes of deposition, the laying down of sediments as those currents spread sediment layers. Then toward the end of the flood, we have an episode of erosion. Deposition, early in the flood, we can explain all of this. Erosion, late in the flood, we can explain that. We've got a good explanation for some of this large-scale geology. It's the flood and the things happening in the flood, like this process here of catastrophic plate tectonics. The edges of the continent, which were pulled down when the plates were sinking, bounce back up to generate some of the present-day coastal mountain ranges. If you think of the coastal mountain ranges out in BC, as the Pacific plate is being pulled down here by gravity, there's friction here and it pulls down the continent. And then any sediment that had accumulated here, it piles up at the edge of the continent all over this area. And then when the motion stops, the continent bounces back up and then you have these mountain ranges. Have you ever flown to Vancouver and looked out at the mountains? The mountains are all sedimentary rock, aren't they? Those jagged peaks, they're all sedimentary rock. But the layers are no longer horizontal, are they? They're no longer in the situation they were when they were laid down. They're laid down horizontally. Now, they're this way and that way and broken and bent. And that's the kind of thing that this process would produce. You've got those layers building up, and then at the end of the flood, you have the rising up of the edges of the continent, producing coastal mountain ranges. Warm oceans after the flood result in greatly increased evaporation. High levels of volcanic dust block some of the sun's radiation, making the continents cooler and leading to a post-flood ice age. Yes, there was an ice age. It happened immediately after the flood. Here's a map showing the extent of the glaciers from the North Pole looking on down. There's North America. You can see at one point our area here was covered with these kilometers-thick glaciers that, under the tremendous weight of all that ice and snow, scoured the landscape. There's good evidence for that. They went down some distance into the States here, but Mexico has never seen a glacier. In the height of the Ice Age, Mexico would have been a nice place to live. Over here in Europe, you can see Moscow was covered, Berlin, but it never got down to, you know, Spain and places like that. The Book of Job, those events taking place shortly after the flood, perhaps during the time of the Ice Age, because in the Book of Job, like no other book in the Bible, there's mention of ice and snow and winter storms, and you have all of this terminology of blizzards and that kind of thing in the Book of Job. Now, not where Job was. Job was in the Middle East. And it was always nice there. But further north and much further south, there would have been the Ice Age going on after the flood. Is there evidence that this happened recently? Evolutionists believe that the continents moved apart as well, but they believe that it happened over millions of years. And they believe that it's still ongoing. That the Atlantic Ocean is opening up, and it is. There's still a bit of a residual motion as the plates are hanging there today. There's occasionally still a little bit of residual motion. That's how we get some earthquakes. In some cases, earthquakes are produced by a variety of different methods, but that's one of the things that produces earthquakes. It's those heavy plates that every once in a while slip a little bit. But is there evidence that this process happened recently? In other words, evidence to fit the Bible, not over millions of years. Well, yes, there is. A number of years ago, measurements were made of the density or the temperature of the rocks deep inside the earth. And here it is represented. Here's the data that came back represented in this picture here. The gray sphere in the middle you see there represents the core of the earth. The red areas are high temperature rock. The blue areas are low temperature rock. What astonished geologists was, why is there so much low temperature rock down around the core? If those are the plates that have been slowly sinking over millions of years, that should already have heated up to the temperature down around the core. Why is it still so cold? And creationists looked at that and we thought, it's because that material hasn't been down there long enough to warm up to the temperature down around the core. There's evidence that it happened recently, not the evolutionary version of millions of years. Furthermore, a similar catastrophe occurred recently on Venus. NASA's Magellan spacecraft had cloud-penetrating radar to map the surface of the planet for the first time. Venus is intensely cloud-covered. That's why it's so bright at night. Venus is one of the brightest objects in the sky. It looks like a star, but it's a planet. It's covered with white clouds all the time. And for the first time in the 90s, with the Magellan spacecraft, we saw the surface of Venus. We were able to look through the clouds of Venus. And when the data came back, astronomers were astonished. They saw a surface of Venus that looks remarkably new and fresh. There's an impact crater. There's something that slammed into the surface of Venus. And the ejecta blanket, the material that's been ejected out of that impact crater, is pristine. It's clean. There's very little sign of erosion. These things, according to evolutionists, are supposed to be millions of years old. It looks like it happened yesterday. Where's the erosion that you would expect? All of this material here should be eroded away, and you're just left with a crater. And over again, there's these impact craters that look like they happened just very, very recently. And astronomers were scratching their heads and thinking, how do we explain the surface of Venus? It's supposed to be millions of years old. Today, astronomers accept that this process that I've just described took place on Venus, on a planetary scale. That the entire surface of Venus has sunk, the original surface has sunk into Venus and been replaced completely by a new surface. Astronomers are happy to accept that plate tectonics could happen quickly. Dr. Baumgartner demonstrated that it can happen quickly. Astronomers and geophysicists, when they look at Venus, they believe, yes, this process can happen quickly. It happened on Venus, but no, it could never happen on Earth. They're fine with it happening on Venus, but it couldn't have anything to do with the Bible or with the flood or God's judgment on sin or anything like that. But interesting. The next step was a 3D computer model. Well, we had a two-dimensional computer model. You had length and depth and so on. But now we need to apply it to a sphere, the sphere of the Earth. So Dr. Baumgartner broke up the sphere of the Earth into ever finer shapes and pieces that the computer could work with, 1.3 million of these little pieces. And into every one of those little cells, they all have to interact with each other in the right way and have all the conservation of energy equations and everything else that goes into that. If you see a mistake there, be sure and let me know, and I'll just pass that on to Dr. Baumgartner for his enlightenment. Now, the outputs from the Cray supercomputer this time look like this. It's kind of like it's a 3D picture from space, sort of thing. And again, there's what will become Africa. Here is what will become the Atlantic Ocean down here. That's sort of the shape of the original supercontinent, something like that. Here again is a temperature scale. You can see the dark blue areas are subduction zones. That's where ocean plates are sinking into the Earth. There's a huge subduction zone along the bottom of Asia and down into the ocean over here. Along the west coast of both North and South America, you've got a subduction zone. And then the red and yellow and green, those are hot. That's hot material coming to the surface to form new ocean floor. So that's going to happen here in the where the Atlantic Ocean is going to appear as well. That's early in the process, and here's kind of a cross-section of what that would look like. Here's cool material, cold material, heavier than this green material, the mantle here, being pulled by gravity down toward the core. And in other places, hot material is starting to come up, well up through the mantle, and replace the cold sinking ocean floor. There's a little bit later in the process. You can see a lot of cold material is being pulled by gravity toward the core into the mantle. And in other places, hot material is coming up to form new ocean floor. There's a little bit later in the process from space. Here you can see the Atlantic Ocean, that mid-Atlantic ridge opening up. There's a massive area out here, out in the Pacific, that is producing new ocean floor. There's the subduction zone. A dark blue area. Here's a subduction zone here, plates sinking into the earth. And notice the you probably can't see them from the back, the vectors, the arrows here that give relative speed and direction. Look at India. Here's India. It's going to slam up against Asia. What happens when they collide? Bang, push up the Himalayas. Get the Himalayan mountain chain. Some mountain chains are the result of the collision of two plates. Some work has been done on if India and Asia, if they were moving at the evolutionary speeds of, 2 inches per year or something, is there enough energy there to push up the Himalayas? And the answer is no. You need to smash those continents together at a higher rate of speed in order to get that mountain chain. There isn't enough energy there to push up those mountains if they're moving slowly. So what are the conclusions? Evidence from the NASA Magellan mission for a rapid global resurfacing of Venus demonstrates that mantle instability is real. Geologists are happy to accept that this can happen quickly, that there's instability, that everything that creationists were saying, they're happy to accept that it happened on another planet, but they'll have nothing to do with it happening on Earth. But yeah, it's real. The physics supports it. Absolutely. Computer modeling verifies that the physics will allow for runaway plate subduction. It can go faster and faster and faster. Evidence that a single global catastrophe produced the fossil record is extremely compelling. The more than 500 million years commonly assigned to this portion of the geological record is therefore an illusion. Half a billion years, 500 million years, are commonly assigned between the very lowest sedimentary rocks, preserving the very simplest life in evolutionary terms, to the very highest sedimentary rock. That distance is supposed to cover half a billion years, 500 million years, between when the lowest sedimentation was laid down and when the top finished. Half a billion years. But if this process is anywhere close to being accurate, and if our Bibles are true, then the fossil record isn't half a billion years old. It's the record of the plants and animals that were buried at the time of the flood. And as I said when we started, any notion that interprets the fossil record, all of that sedimentary rock, as being evidence of the history of the earth over millions of years, that interpretation is seriously flawed. And now there's some pretty significant science to back it up. The world's most advanced computer model done by the world's leading plate tectonic modeler. Interesting. In other words, an old Earth is not supported by scientific evidence from geology. And yet all you hear in geology is millions of years, millions of years. But it just isn't there. The geological data and cutting-edge scientific research support the biblical record of a world-destroying global flood. And finally, since science always changes, Christians must never use the latest scientific conjectures to reinterpret the history in Genesis. In the late 1700s and early 1800s, when scientists began, or not necessarily scientists, people began saying, let's not think about the flood when we look at rock layers. Let's think of millions of years laying these things down. The pastors and theologians back then who began trying to blend millions of years with the Bible, what should they have done? I mean, it may have been difficult. People back then didn't have creation ministries with our scientists and trying to explain these things. They didn't know what scientists, the assumptions involved in the dating methods that scientists were using. They should have said, you know what, Mr. Scientist, I'm not sure how you're getting the millions of years, but I'm going to go with the biblical text. That's what they should have done. Instead, many much of the church adopted millions of years. They should have had a wait and see attitude. Let's wait and see. Maybe in the future we'll discover where your research that supposedly supports millions of years has gone off the rails. Maybe one day science will catch up and will verify the Bible. We'll confirm what it says in the Bible. Well, guess what? We're there. Science has caught up. There's powerful scientific models that support a world-destroying global flood. And if there's questions that haven't been answered in this series of talks here at this church, we need to have a wait-and-see attitude. Instead of going to the Bible and saying, well, we really ought to modify it based on what we're hearing the scientists say. We've got to understand Scripture differently. We should say, you know, it's the Word of God. Let's just go with the biblical text. And if there hasn't been research done to show where those scientists have gone off the rails, then let's just wait and see. Maybe we'll do some of that research with our guys or some of the other creation groups that are out there. Do some research. And it's a great time to be a Christian today because we have so much that supports the Bible and answers some of these questions. How do we explain this particular geologic feature or that one there? Well, it happened during the flood, yes, but we have some more details. And we can understand these things and then take them to evolutionists, take them to people who don't believe the Bible and say, well, look at this model that creationists have been playing with and working on. Look at what it explains. It explains the huge extent of rock layers. It explains mountain ranges and collision of plates in the Himalayas. And explains the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and the fit of the continents and the magnetic banding back and forth. And it explains why there's cool rock down near the mantle. It explains what happened on Venus. What a great time to be a Christian. If we can learn some of these things and kind of drop that in a non-believer's lap. Now, what do you think about that, Mr. and Mrs. Non-Believer? The Bible's really true. It really, really is. We start our thinking with the Bible. There was a global flood. We've got a few more details here that are kind of fun to think about. And we can say, look, this makes sense. Christianity is not a religion that requires blind faith. It's been called in the past the intelligent man's faith. You can ask questions. You can explore the biblical text. You can ask questions and get answers to some of these things. Wonderful time to be a Christian. You know what? There's a lot more information on our website, creation.com. If you're searching for information, it's a fantastic place to visit. If I'm assuming most of you have internet in your homes. It's all free, obviously. Lots of information there. Creation Magazine, I've talked about it before. Can't say enough about it. It had a huge impact on my life. Many of you have signed up. Well done. You can look forward to at least a year, if you signed up for a year, of continuing to get a steady stream of faith-building information. Well done to those of you who signed up. To those of you who are still thinking about it, the sign-up sheets are at the back there. We're not going to pass it around. The advantage with signing up today, rather than maybe tonight after we're finished here, or tomorrow or next week, is today you get free stuff. If you sign up online tomorrow, you're not going to get any free stuff. So do it tonight. Free back issue, 2 DVDs for a 3-year subscription. The sign-up forms are at the back there. The Creation Answers book has a chapter on plate tectonics. It has a chapter on Noah's flood. It has a chapter on the ark. It has a chapter on where did Cain get his wife. It has a chapter on natural selection. It has a chapter on mutations. It has a chapter on how do we understand the days in Genesis. Could they be literal days? More than 60 of the most asked questions in a single resource. Creation Answers book. The Mount St. Helens DVD. Here's a DVD about geology. It's a fantastic witnessing tool. There's a couple of Bible verses that Dr. Austin, the lead researcher here, he puts in right at the end. But all the way through, he's talking about, wow, isn't this interesting? Look what Mount St. Helens did. Oh, mud flow carved out a canyon and laid down fine layers. That's interesting. Let's relate this to Grand Canyon. What would cause Grand Canyon? Huh? Something like a global flood might cause Grand Canyon based on our research at Mount St. Helens on a smaller scale. Isn't that interesting? So you can give that to a non-Christian and get them thinking, hey, you know what, maybe these Christians have a point. Maybe there was a global flood to explain some of the geology that we see. Fantastic witnessing tool. Stones and Bones. I've mentioned this one before. It's our little booklet. It's just $4.25. It's a little booklet jam-packed with evidence against evolution. All kinds of evidence against evolution. This one here by one of our geologists, Dr. Taz Walker, Biblical Geology, Properly Understanding the Rocks. That's the subtitle, Properly Understanding the Rocks. Dr. Walker, he's actually on my board here. He's one of our board members here in Canada. He's over in Australia. He works at the Australian office. And the difference between Dr. Walker and some of the other scientists is Dr. Walker can present at a non-geologist level. He's an excellent presenter. He can present things without being technical. You'll actually get it. A lot of the scientists, they're talking way up here, and they're thinking, well, everybody knows what I'm talking about, using these fancy terms and stuff. Dr. Walker isn't like that. It's a fantastic DVD as an introduction to geology for the Christian. Fantastic DVD. Here's one on biology. We talked about this on Thursday night. Living things change over time, but the type of change that scientists see has nothing to do with evolution. And that DVD explains that in some detail. Now, we have another magazine. We actually publish two magazines. I've talked about Creation Magazine many times. The Journal of Creation is our other magazine. If you think the family version of Creation Magazine, and it's a family magazine, short articles, color pictures, if that's not really your cup of tea, and you're looking for something with a little more meat, I might suggest the Journal of Creation. The journal does not have short articles. It does not have color pictures. The articles are technical, and they've got charts and graphs and formulas and things like that. Now, if you're getting excited sitting there listening to this, you might want to consider subscribing to the Journal of Creation. The peer-reviewed articles from scientists all over the world, Bible-believing young earth creation scientists all over the world, appear here first. It's a fantastic magazine. I've got a little book at the back there called Life in the Great Ice Age. As I mentioned briefly a few minutes ago, there was an ice age. This is a book written by a meteorologist, by a weatherman, Mike Ord and his wife Beverly. They wrote this book together. It's the story of a boy living with his dog there, and he kind of explores what it would have been like living just after the flood in the time of the ice age. He's a Christian. Obviously, this is all within a biblical context. An ice age after the flood, written by a weatherman. Now, parents, you might be saying, well, this looks like a kid's book. It's sort of a kid's book. But you know what? The good thing about kid's books is that we can all understand them, right? So pick up a copy and tell yourself you're getting it for your kids. But actually, you can get it for yourself and not be embarrassed, okay? It's a great book for Christians on how do we explain an ice age. What might it have been like living at that point in the history of the earth? And there's so much else that we could say about that. It's been a thrill to be here. As I said when we started, I occasionally do get a chance to do multiple sessions to kind of the same group or at the same church night after night. And this has been a real joy for me. Now, a number of you have asked about, well, how are sales going? And so you get the assumption from a lot of folks, and I've heard a number of comments here, is that, well, the way CMI survives is through book sales. That's not accurate. The money that comes from the book sales is enough to pay to produce the books and to house the books. We have a warehouse and so on. We're supported by donations. People who want to see this information get out to churches all over Canada, they support us. We have a monthly, you can sign up for a monthly support thing off your credit card or whatever. Now, there's some little cards at the back. And this is a way that you can support Creation Ministries and not have to send us any money. If you want to donate, hey, but certainly it enables us to continue doing what we're doing. There's Air Miles cards at the back, and you can pick these up for free. You don't have to ask me. There's a pile back there. Just take one on the way out. You're familiar with Air Miles, right? You go to a company like Rona or something that gives Air Miles, and when you purchase something, you swipe the CMI Air Miles card. And the Air Miles will be collected by people all over Canada, and it goes to the CMI Air Miles account. Our event planners use those Air Miles to book flights for our speakers. You can help us, and it doesn't cost you anything. And if you have an Air Miles MasterCard or American Express card, you can call up the customer service department, your credit card company, and say, can you switch my Air Miles account to the CMI account number? It's on this card here. And so then all the Air Miles that you collect will come into CMI's account. That's a way that you can support CMI. And one more thing before we close. There's a bunch of flyers. I haven't mentioned this yet. I should have mentioned it a number of times. There's going to be a Creation Super Conference in August in Muskoka, a couple hours north of Toronto. There's 11 speakers going to be there. I'm going to be there. Calvin Smith is going to be there. We've got astronomers. We've got, who do we have here? We've got geneticists. Dr. John Sanford is going to be there. Marine biologists. Dr. Sarfati is going to be there. You want to see him play blindfolded chess? He's going to be there. Dr. Emil Silvestru, he's one of our scientists in Canada. He grew up as an atheist. So did Calvin Smith, by the way. He's going to be there. Gary Bates, the guy who wrote the book back there, Alien Intrusion, UFOs and the Evolution Connection. He's going to be there. He's going to do his UFO talk. You can, during that week, it's from the 14th to the 19th, the whole 6 days of teaching. And one of our newest speakers in Canada here, Jim Mason. Dr. Jim Mason, he's got a PhD in experimental nuclear physics. I love the way that sounds. What's your PhD in? Experimental nuclear physics. Oh, wow. That's cool. That just sounds neat. He's going to be there. And anyways, you'll be able to eat with these guys and have lunch and dinner with them and so ask them questions. We're making our speakers as available to the conference participants as possible. If you're interested in more details, there's a bunch of flyers near the cash box at the back there. You can take one of the flyers, registration information on the back. It's a family conference. You can bring your kids. There's going to be VBS-style teaching during the morning and evening sessions. So parents, you can participate in the teaching in the main sessions while the kids get teaching from some of our staff and the staff up at NBC. Thank you so much for this time. You've been very attentive, and I've really enjoyed sticking around afterwards and having some of the discussions. We haven't had a lot of question times, but there's a lot of people that's, well, what about this, and what about this, and what do you mean galaxies way out there really are millions of years old, and are you a heretic, and things like that, and why do you hate poodles so much? And we've had these great conversations afterwards, and I'm just thrilled with the enthusiasm of some of you, wrestling with these ideas and beginning to really take them and make them your own and think about some of these things and how you can use them in evangelism as we understand the evolutionary world that's outside of these windows here. Fantastic. Let's close in prayer and then we'll be dismissed. Gracious God and Heavenly Father, we thank you once again. We thank you most of all for your great mercy in sending your Son Jesus to come and shed his blood to die on a cross to pay for our sins. We thank you for so many of the other benefits that produced. We thank you for life and breath and everything. We thank you that we live in a country like Canada where there's still freedom of religion, where we're able to meet like this and discuss the finer points, the details of creation. And we're able to refute ideas like evolution, the popular notion that so many people have been blinded by. And we ask that you'd give each and every one of us a heart to reach those lost people, that we would have some information, maybe even as simple as showing them a picture of Dr. Mary Schweitzer's unfossilized dinosaur bone and asking folks, what do you think of this? How does this fit with evolution? And just simple things. Lord, we ask that you'd impress those simple evidences onto our thinking so that we might be able to share them with people who don't believe that your word is true. And as we've prayed a number of times before, we ask that through those efforts, where we're taking the gospel to the nations, that many would come to know your Son Jesus, for it's in his name we pray. Amen. All right, thank you very much. And if there are no further announcements or anything, then we are dismissed. We're dismissed. Thanks.